Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Sod 1 of For the Record program number 622, titled More on the Nazi Origins of Islamic Fascism. This program is being recorded on January 27th of the year 2008. What we're going to be doing in this program is basically examining in its entirety, recapitulating in its entirety would be a better word, a lecture that was given at the University of Leeds in the United Kingdom on October 10th of 2007. The lecture was given by German author Matthias Kunzel, and he is the author of a recent book titled Jihad and Jew Hatred, Islamism, Nazism, and the Roots of 9/11. And he was invited to give a lecture at the University of Leeds, and the lecture was titled Hitler's Legacy, Islamic Anti-Semitism in the Middle East, The Impact of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, I've spoken about Islamic fascism at great length in many, many, many programs, both by myself and with other people. There is a great body of evidence available on the Spitfire website. Suffice it to say, by way of introduction, a couple of points. One can only truly understand Islamic fascism as part of the fascist international, as part of the worldwide fascist community, and it is only significant in the context of its intersections with other fascist elements. In that regard, the AMIA bombing of 1994, I think, is something of an archetype. What we had was Hezbollah, Islamic Shiite fascists, utilizing Argentinian fascists of the World Anti-Communist League P2 variety, and some of the Operation Condor types, but at the operational level, the Argentinian police, who were found to be collaborators in the AMIA bombing, again authored by Hezbollah, were found to be members in an FBI investigation of White Aryan Resistance. That's an American white supremacist organization founded by Tom Metzger. And I would also point out that in many ways, fascism in the Muslim world plays into some of the upper realms, so to speak, of fascism in the West. The intersections between the Bank al-Taqwa milieu and the Bush administration, and also the intersections between the Bank al-Taqwa milieu and the P2-connected regime of Silvio Berlusconi in Italy are cases in point. It's unfortunate that Islamic fascism or Islamofascism has had as its primary focal points the most inappropriate spokespersons such as Ann Coulter and others. Ironically enough, Ann Coulter used to be the press secretary for Spencer Abraham, the Arab-American supporter of some of these same groups, who also was the energy secretary for the Bush administration and one of the primary architects of the Bush administration's energy policy. And having Ann Coulter, Eva Braunschweiger, as the primary advocate for, or as a signature advocate for the need to oppose Islamic fascism, only strengthens the case of the Islamic fascists themselves. Anyway, we are going to spend the rest of this program examining this lecture in its entirety. And again, for background, I strongly encourage members of the listening audience to use the cornucopia of information about Islamic fascism and fascism in its other forms available on the Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com, and support the work done by Spitfire and by Al, the heroic individual who maintains that website for me. Again, the lecture. Hitler's Legacy, Islamic Anti-Semitism in the Middle East, The Impact of the Muslim Brotherhood, given at the University of Leeds, October 10th, 2007. This is by Matthias Kunzel, the author of the book Jihad and Jew Hatred, Islamism, Nazism, and the Roots of 9/11. Today, I will be laying special emphasis on the anti-Semitism of the ancestor of all forms of Islamism, the Muslim Brotherhood. Why? Because it seems to me that this organization has a particularly strong presence in Britain. Because as far as I can tell, only in Britain has it succeeded in forging an alliance with certain sections of the left, the Socialist Workers' Party and Ken Livingston spring to mind here. This alliance might also partly explain why one hears proposals being voiced in Britain that leave us in Germany, mindful of what happened in 1933, simply stunned. I am referring here to proposals for a boycott of Israel, and I appreciate the British government's response to the report of the All-Party Parliamentary Inquiry into Anti-Semitism, which states that such selective boycotts are anti-Jewish in practice and are, quote, an assault on academic freedom and intellectual exchange, unquote. Islamic anti-Semitism does not, of course, only affect Britain. In some circles in Germany, too, anti-Semitism has increasingly become a part of Muslim identity. We hear Jew being used as a term of abuse, we witness the adulation of rappers who call for attacks on Jews, and we hear the term Nazi used as a compliment. In Berlin, a Muslim schoolboy called for all the Jews to be gassed, unquote. A gang of school students trapped one of their fellow pupils in a chemistry lab, telling him, now we will turn on the gas taps, unquote. While during a visit to the Museum of German History, a group of Muslim students gathered around a replica of an Auschwitz gas chamber and applauded. You see, they did not view the Holocaust as a warning, nor were they denying that it happened. It was being taken as an inspiration, as proof that it is possible that millions of Jews can be killed. But are things any better in Britain? Quote, in Hempstead Garden Suburbs, swastikas and the words Kill All Jews and Allah were dubbed on the house and car of Justin Stebbing, reports the Times. Dr. Stebbing, who works at a hospital, said, I felt violated. It's horrible, unquote. Swastika, kill all the Jews, and Allah, the very topic of my talk today. According to journalist Richard Littlejohn, quote, I met a Jack the Ripper tour guide in East London who was beaten up by a group of Muslim youths who took one look at his period costume, long black coat and black hat, and assumed he was an Orthodox Jew and therefore deserving of a kicking. They didn't want a dirty Jew in their neighborhood, unquote. Finally, an opinion poll of 2006, according to the Times, quote, revealed that a horrifying 37% of Muslims polled believed that the Jewish community in Britain was a legitimate target, and no fewer than 46% thought that the Jewish community was in league with Freemasons to control the media and politics, unquote. By the way, in that regard, I would refer listeners to a recent For the Record program, which will be footnoted or annotated in the written description for this broadcast, in which the Hamas Charter is related, and the Hamas Charter, among other things, refers to the Rotarians, the Lions Club, and similar organizations as Jewish fronts for the international Jewish conspiracy. That might seem like a strange thing to be talking about, to be citing the Freemasons and the Rotarians and the Lions Club as Jewish or international Zionist front organizations. That is straight Nazi ideology. And when one sees this in the political manifestos of Islamist organizations, it is perhaps the most direct echo, the most direct manifestation of the profound and explicit Nazi antecedents of this particular Islamic form of fascism. Continuing with Matthias Kunzel's lecture, this is not the normal anti-Semitism of racial prejudice or religious and social discrimination. This is also not the kind of hostility to Jews found in the Quran. We are dealing here with a hardcore anti-Semitism which dehumanizes and demonizes Jews and which has a great deal in common with Nazi ideology. In Islamism, this hatred of Jews is given a further radical edge by its association with the idea of religious war, with a global religious mission, a belief in paradise, and the rewards of martyrdom. This makes it at the same time suicidal and genocidal. Let's take the example of Mohammed Sadiq Khan, the ringleader of the London Tube bombings, who lived in Leeds and had worked as a youth worker in Beeston. What drove him to blow himself up amidst innocent people? The testamentary video of Sadiq Khan is very clear. It shows no sign of desperation, but a soldier's determination. Let me quote Sadiq Khan. Quote, Our driving motivation doesn't come from tangible commodities that this world has to offer. We are at war, and I am a soldier, unquote. The testamentary video of Shahzad Tanweer, another 7/7 perpetrator who lived in Leeds and studied at Leeds Metropolitan University, is very clear as well. Let me quote him. Quote, "We are 100% committed to the cause of Islam. We love death the way you love life," unquote. This culture of death, which extinguishes the instinct that normally unites all human beings, the survival instinct, is something beyond imagination. It is something that George Orwell was not able to write about. The shocking malice of such messages leads people who wish to keep a firm hold on normal patterns of reason to suppress them or block them out. Quote, "We instinctively look away, as we do whenever we are confronted with monstrous deformity," unquote, writes David Gerlenter. Nothing is harder or more frightening to look at than a fellow human being who is bent out of shape, unquote. But while this may to some extent excuse the attitude of the ordinary citizen, it cannot justify the way the media, the academia, and the politicians have been behaving. Our task is to do the opposite. We must not look away, but instead look inside the fantasy world of the perpetrators and seek to grasp the imminent logic behind their actions. If one wants to combat and repel the Islamist ideology, one must first take it seriously as a specific outlook with its own principles and history. And indeed, contemporary Islamism can only be explained in the context of its 80-year-old history. This is shown by the example of Shahzad Tanweer. With his "We love death the way you love life," he was placing himself in the direct tradition of Hassan al-Banna, who founded the Muslim Brotherhood in 1928. 10 years later, in 1938, Hassan al-Banna published his concept of jihad in an article entitled "The Industry of Death," unquote, which was to become famous. Here, the term "industry of death" denotes not something horrible, but an ideal. Al-Banna wrote, quote, "Only a nation that perfects the industry of death and which knows how to die nobly, God gives proud life in this world and eternal grace in the life to come," unquote. This slogan was enthusiastically taken up by the troops of God, as the Muslim Brothers called themselves. As their battalions marched down Cairo's boulevards in semi-fascist formation, they would burst into song. "We are not afraid of death, we desire it. Let us die to redeem the Muslims," unquote. The approach I intend to take today is an historical one. My talk centers on three excursions into history. The first takes us in greater detail back to the roots of Islamism in the Muslim Brotherhood. And this next section of the lecture is titled, "The Roots of Islamism." Despite common misconceptions, Islamism was not born during the 1960s, but during the 1930s. Its rise was inspired not by the failure of Nasserism, but by the rise of fascism and of Nazism. It was the organization of the Muslim Brotherhood, founded in 1928 in Egypt, that established Islamism as a mass movement. The significance of the Brotherhood to Islamism is comparable to that of the Bolshevik Party to communism. It was, and remains to this day, the ideological reference point and organizational core for all later Islamist groups, including Al-Qaeda and Hamas, or the group around Sadiq Khan. I would also point out that, although now largely funded by Shia Iran, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, one of whose founders was Sami al-Arian, a literal hero to the so-called progressive community, a darling of Pacifica Radio, that too is a Muslim Brotherhood offshoot, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, like other Islamist organizations, use the fascist/Nazi salute. Continuing. It is true that British colonial policy produced Islamism insofar as Islamism viewed itself as a resistance movement against cultural modernity, unquote. Their liberation struggle, however, had more in common with the liberation struggle of the Nazis than with any progressive movement. Thus, the Brotherhood advocated the replacement of parliamentaryism by an organic state order based on the caliphate. It demanded the abolition of interest and profit in favor of a forcibly imposed community of interests between capital and labor. At the forefront of the Brotherhood's efforts lay the struggle against all the sensual and materialistic, unquote, temptations of the capitalist and communist world. At the tender age of 13, the pubescent Albana had founded a Society for the Prevention of the Forbidden, unquote, and this, in essence, is what the Brothers were and are, a community of male zealots whose primary concern is to prevent all the sensual and sexual sins forbidden according to their interpretation of the Quran. Their signature was most clearly apparent when they periodically reduced their local nightclubs, brothels, and cinemas, constantly identified with Jewish influence, to ashes. Gripped by this phobia, the Society of Muslim Brothers from the day of its foundation provided a haven for any man dedicated to the restoration of male supremacy. At the very time when the liberation of women from the inferiority decreed by Islam was gradually getting underway, the Muslim Brotherhood set itself up as the rallying point for the restoration of patriarchal domination. It was, on the one hand, a conservative religious movement. For Albana, only a return to Orthodox Islam could pave the way for an end to the intolerable conditions and humiliations of Muslims and newly established the righteous Islamic order. It was, at the same time, a revolutionary political movement and, as such, in many respects, a trailblazer. The Brotherhood was the first Islamic organization to put down roots in the cities and to organize a mass movement able in 1948 to muster 1 million people in Egypt alone. It was a populist and activist, not an elitist movement, and it was the first movement that systematically set about building a kind of Islamist international, unquote. The Islamists' answer to everything was the call for a new order based on Sharia, or Islamic law. But the Brotherhood's jihad was not directed primarily against the British. Rather, it focused almost exclusively on Zionism and the Jews. Membership in the Brotherhood shot up from 800 to 200,000 between 1936 and 1938. In those 2 years, the Brotherhood conducted only one major campaign in Egypt, a campaign directed against Zionism and the Jews. The starting shot for this campaign, which established the Brotherhood as an anti-Semitic mass movement, was fired by a rebellion in Palestine directed against Jewish immigration and initiated by the notorious Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin al-Husseini. The Brotherhood organized mass demonstrations in Egyptian cities under the slogans, "Down with the Jews" and "Jews get out of Egypt and Palestine," unquote. Their Jew hatred drew on the one hand on Islamic sources. First, Islamists considered and still consider Palestine an Islamic territory, Dar al-Islam, where Jews must not run a single village, let alone a state. Second, Islamists justify their aspiration to eliminate the Jews of Palestine by invoking the example of Muhammad, who in the 7th century not only expelled 2 Jewish tribes from Medina, but also beheaded the entire male population of a 3rd Jewish tribe, before proceeding to sell all the women and children into slavery. Third, they find support and encouragement for their actions and plans in the Quranic dictum that Jews are to be considered the worst enemy of the believers. Their Jew hatred was also inspired... Their Jew hatred was also inspired by Nazi influences. Leaflets called for a boycott of Jewish goods and Jewish shops, and the Brotherhood's newspaper, Al Nadir, carried a regular column on the danger of the Jews of Egypt, unquote, which published the names and addresses of Jewish businessmen and allegedly Jewish newspaper publishers all over the world, attributing every evil from communism to brothels to the Jewish danger, unquote. The Brotherhood's campaign used not only Nazi-like patterns of action and slogans, but also German funding. As the historian Brynar Lea recounts in this monograph on the Brotherhood, quote, "documents seized in the flat of Wilhelm Stellbogen, the director of the German news agency affiliated to the German legation in Cairo, show that prior to October 1939, the Muslim Brothers received subsidies from this organization." Stellbogen was instrumental in transferring these funds to the Brothers, which are considerably larger than the subsidies offered to other British anti-British activists. These transfers appeared to have been coordinated by Haj Amin al-Husseini and some of his Palestinian contacts in Cairo, unquote. To summarize our first trip into history, we saw that the rise of Nazism and Islamism took place in the same period. This was no accident, for both movements represented attempts to answer the world economic crisis of 1929 and the crisis of liberal capitalism. However different their answers may have been, they shared a crucial central feature. In both cases, the sense of belonging to a homogeneous community was created through mobilizing against the Jews. Initially, however, European anti-Semitism had proved to be an ineffective tool in the Arab world. Why? Because the European fantasy of the Jewish world conspiracy was foreign to the original Islamic view of the Jews. Only in the legend of Jesus Christ did the Jews appear as a deadly and powerful force who allegedly went so far as to kill God's only son. Islam was quite a different story. Here, it was not the Jews who murdered the prophet, but the prophet who in Medina murdered the Jews. As a result, the characteristic features of Christian anti-Semitism did not develop in the Muslim world. There were no fears of Jewish conspiracy and domination, no charges of diabolic evil. Instead, the Jews were treated with contempt or condescending tolerance. This cultural inheritance made the idea that the Jews of all people could represent a permanent danger for the Muslims and might control the media and politics in league with Freemasons seem absurd. This brings us to our second point. The transfer of European anti-Semitism to the Muslim world between 1937 and 1945 under the impact of Nazi propaganda. We're going to talk about this in a second. A couple of points I'd like to bring up just in passing here. Remember the concept of the Earth Island, the giant landmass stretching from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, much of what we call the Middle East, the former Soviet Union, India, Pakistan, and China. It contains most of the world's landmass, most of the world's population, most of the world's natural resources, and most of the world's oil. Across the middle of it is a stretch of Muslim population. And across much of it, for much of the 20th century, was the Soviet Union, a communist country, along with China. One of the things that I would note in this regard is that the Muslim Brotherhood, which is an Islamic fascist organization, and Opus Dei, a Catholic fascist organization, were both founded in 1928, and the upshot of both was to present religious fascist organizations bracketing or flanking the former Soviet Union on its western and southern / eastern flanks. And that is something to consider. Also, as we've seen in many of our programs with the Bank al-Taqwa and with the Skorzeny / Galen contingent that was sent to the Middle East to rebuild Nasser's general staff and intelligence service, the transfer of Nazi propaganda to the Middle East accelerated in the aftermath of World War II in many ways. We're going to continue with a section of Matthias Kunzel's lecture, Islamism and National Socialism. Amin al-Husseini, the infamous Mufti of Jerusalem who was closely connected to the Muslim Brotherhood, was already seeking an alliance with Nazi Germany as early as the spring of 1933. At first, however, Berlin was dismissive. On the one hand, Hitler had already stated his belief in the racial inferiority, unquote, of the Arabs in Mein Kampf, while on the other hand, the Nazis were extremely anxious not to jeopardize British appeasement. In June of 1937, however, the Nazis changed course. The trigger was the Peel Plan's two-state solution. Berlin wanted at all costs to prevent the birth of a Jewish state and thus welcomed the Mufti's advances. Arab anti-Semitism would now get a powerful new promoter. A central role in the propaganda offensive was played by a Nazi wireless station now almost totally forgotten. Since the 1936 Berlin Olympics, a village called Zeessen, Z-E-E-S-E-N, located to the south of Berlin, had been home to what was at the time the world's most powerful shortwave radio transmitter. Between April of 1939 and April of 1945, Radio Zeessen reached out to the illiterate Muslim masses through daily Arabic programs, which also went out in Persian and Turkish. At that time, listening to the radio in the Arab world took place primarily in public squares or bazaars and coffee houses. No other radio station was more popular than this Nazi Zeessen service, which skillfully mingled anti-Semitic propaganda with quotations from the Quran and Arab music. The Second World War allies were presented as lackeys of the Jews, and the picture of the United Jewish Nations, unquote, drummed into the audience. At the same time, the Jews were attacked as the worst enemies of Islam. The Jew since the time of Muhammad has never been a friend of the Muslim. The Jew is the enemy, and it pleases Allah to kill him, unquote. Since 1941, Zaysen's Arabic programming has been directed by the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. Beginning again. Since 1941, Zaysen's Arabic programming had been directed by the Mufti of Jerusalem, who had emigrated to Berlin. The Mufti's aim was to unite all the Arab lands in a common hatred of the British and the Jews, unquote, as he wrote in a letter to Adolf Hitler. Anti-Semitism, based on the notion of a Jewish world conspiracy, however, was not rooted in Islamic tradition, but rather in European ideological models. The Mufti therefore seized on the only instrument that really moved the Arab masses, Islam. He invented a new form of Jew hatred by recasting it in an Islamic mold. He was the first to translate Christian anti-Semitism into Islamic language, thus creating an Islamic anti-Semitism. His first major manifesto bore the title Islam Judaism, Appeal of the Grand Mufti to the Islamic World in the year 1937, unquote. This 31-page pamphlet reached the entire Arab world, and there are indications that Nazi agents helped draw it up. Let me quote at least a short passage from it, quote, "The struggle between the Jews and Islam began when Muhammad fled from Mecca to Medina. The Jewish methods were even in those days the same as now. As always, their weapon was slander. They said that Muhammad was a swindler. They began to ask Muhammad senseless and insoluble questions, and they endeavored to destroy the Muslims. If the Jews could betray Muhammad in this way, how will they betray Muslims today? The verses from the Quran and Hadith prove to you that the Jews were the fiercest opponents of Islam and are still trying to destroy it," unquote. What we have here is a new, popularized form of Jew hatred based on the Oriental folktale tradition, which moves constantly back and forth between the 7th and 20th centuries. This kind of Jew hatred is used today by the British group Hizb ut-Tahrir. In 2002, this organization reproduced a leaflet in its website saying, "The Jews are a people of slander, a treacherous people. They fabricate lies and twist words from their right context. Kill them wherever you find them." Classical Islamic literature had, as a rule, treated Muhammad's clash with the Jews of Medina as a minor episode in the Prophet's life. The anti-Jewish passages in the Quran and Hadith had lain dormant or were considered of little significance during previous centuries. These elements were now invested with new life and vigor, however. Now, the Mufti began to ascribe a truly cosmic significance to the allegedly hostile attitude of the Jewish tribes of Medina to the Prophet. Now, he picked out the occasional outbursts of hatred found in the Quran and Hadith and drummed them relentlessly into the minds of Muslims at every available opportunity, including via the Arabic shortwave radio station in Berlin. We have been listening to a lecture given by Matthias Kunzel, a German author, at the University of Leeds on October 10, 2007. The title of his lecture, "Hitler's Legacy, Islamic Anti-Semitism in the Middle East, The Impact of the Muslim Brotherhood." And also, Matthias Kunzel has authored a recent book, "Jihad and Jew Hatred, Islamism, Nazism, and the Roots of 9/11. And we're going to continue with this lecture inside two of the program for background on Islamic fascism and the Muslim Brotherhood. Check the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 622. Update on the Nazi origins of Islamic fascism. This program is being recorded on January 27th of the year 2008. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.